They're circling now, then falling, descending in a slow gyre, dropping so gently that their approach can barely be discerned. They are hawks in the form of men, and the one who leads them is a being doubly transformed, lost and found, human and bird, youngest of them, yet strangely old. He has endured, and in this endurance he has been forged anew. He has seen a world beyond this one. He has glimpsed the face of a new god. He is at peace with himself, and so he will wage war. Faster they come, the spiral narrowing, the three almost as one, their coats mantling in the chill fall air. And not a whisper of their approach, not a passing shadow, nor a sparrow startled. Only the stillness of a world waiting to be shattered, and the perfect balance of a life perhaps to be saved, and a life perhaps to be ended. The clouds part, pierced by a shaft of light that catches them in flight, as though they have attracted, however briefly, the attention of a deity long slumbering but now awake, roused by martial clamor and the raising of armies in the name of the captain, the one who waits behind the glass, the god of wasps. And the old god will set his child against them, and the hawks will follow. It was a long time since the gray man had considered the possibility of being caught, for the gray man did not truly exist. He had no physical form. He dwelt alongside another, sharing the same skin, and only at the final breath might there have been a glimpse of the depths of his true nature. Although even then he preferred to remain unseen, concealed in darkness. He was not above causing pain, although this was as much a matter of whim as any particular tastes he might have possessed. A death was only the beginning, which was why he had survived undetected for so long. He could make a kill last for years. Physical pain was finite, for ultimately the body would surrender the soul. But emotional agony was capable of infinite variations, and the subtlest of modifications might release from the wound a new torrent of distress. In the persona he presented to the world, the gray man was a reverse chameleon. His name was Roger Ormsby, and he was small, colorful, and greatly liked. He was in his early 60s, with an impish humor. His hair and beard were white, but neatly trimmed. He proudly carried before him his little pot belly, like a happily expectant mother advertising the pleasure she takes in her burden. He favored red suspenders and vests of unusual design. He wore tweed in winter and linen in summer, preferring creams and tans, but offsetting them with tastefully bright ties and handkerchiefs. He could play the piano and waltz and two-step with ease. But inside Ormsby was a foul thing animating him as a puppeteer works a marionette, and only an expert might have detected the sterility of his renditions of beloved classics as his fingers moved across the keys, or the joyless precision of every move he made on a dance floor. Ormsby did not discuss politics or religion. He took only frivolous subjects seriously, and as a consequence was much valued as a dinner guest. He was a happy widower, faithful to the memory of his departed wife to the extent that he would do no more than flirt with the less lonely widows of Champaign, Illinois, but not so in love with the ghost of his spouse as to allow the loss of her to cloud his spirit or the spirits of others. He was always in demand as a companion for theater, movies, and the occasional light opera, and the absence of a sexual component to his relationships meant that he moved in and out of social situations with ease. He was a friend of the library, a member of the Audubon Society, a regular fixture at lectures on local history, and a generous, but not over-generous, donor to good causes. True, there were some who disliked him, for no man can be loved by all. But in general, such naysayers were regarded by the majority as willfully ornery, unable to accept that someone might simply be a force for contentment in the world. And so Roger Ormsby bobbed through life in his vibrant plumage, advertising his presence, hiding nothing. But when he closed his front door behind him, the artificial light in his eyes was suffocated, and the face of the gray man was pendant like a dead moon in the blackness of his pupils. This is what Roger Ormsby did, or, if you wish, what the gray man did, for they were two aspects of the same entity, like a coat and its lining. He typically targeted his victims carefully, spending months in preparation. He had been known to engage in crimes of opportunity, but they were riskier now than they once were, because cameras were everywhere. In addition, it was difficult to gauge just what one might be appropriating in such a situation, for Ormsby required a very particular set of social circumstances from his victims. They couldn't be loners, isolated from their families and friends. He did not desire discards. The more beloved they were, the better. He wanted children who were cherished. He wanted teenagers from happy homes. He wanted good mothers of children beyond the age of infancy. He wanted emotional engagement. He wanted many lives that he could slowly and painstakingly destroy over a period of years, even decades. Ormsby made people disappear, then watched as those who loved them were left to wonder at their fate. He understood the half-life of hope. It is not despair that destroys us, but its opposite. Hope is the winding, despair the unwinding. Despair brings with it the possibility of an ending. Taken to the extreme, its logical conclusion is death. But hope sustains. It can be exploited. Ormsby's actions had caused some to take their own lives, but he considered this a failure, both on his part and theirs. The ones he killed were merely the first victims, and also the least interesting to him. He liked to watch those who remained as they tried to cope with what had been visited upon them. He knew they would wake each morning and briefly forget that which they had lost, a mother, a son, a daughter. Ormsby avoided taking adult men. He was stronger than he looked, but not so much that he believed he could tackle a grown man, especially not as he grew older. Then, seconds after waking, they would remember again. And that was where the pleasure lay for Ormsby. He was not above goading, reminding. But that was a dangerous business. He had sent items to relatives in the mail. A necklace, a watch, a child's shoe, to enjoy the commotion that followed. He had forced children that he had taken to write letters to their mothers and fathers, informing them that they were in good health and being looked after. Adults, too, might be persuaded to write similar missives, but only under threat of physical harm. He might wait years before sending such notes, depending on the age of the child and the reaction of the parents. He dropped the letters in mailboxes far from home, often when he was on vacation, and always ensured they were not overlooked by cameras. The internet made it easier for him to monitor the progress of his real victims. But Ormsby was wary of leaving an electronic trail. He concealed his searches amid random examinations of newspapers and magazines, often in public libraries or the kind of cyber cafes frequented by immigrants. He did not attend public gatherings for the disappeared, or church services at which the congregation prayed for their safe return, because he knew the authorities monitored such events. It was usually enough for Ormsby to know that the suffering he had inflicted continued unabated. If nothing else, the gray man had a vivid imagination. This was how Ormsby could survive for so long without killing. As the years went by, so too his store of victims increased. He could dip in and out of destroyed lives. He was an emotional vampire. Now, as he drove home, he thought that this metaphor had a pleasing precision under the circumstances. He recalled a scene from Bram Stoker's Dracula, in which the Count returns to his castle and throws to his three vampire brides an infant contained in a sack. At that moment, the trunk of Ormsby's car also contained a child in a sack. Her name was Charlotte Littleton. She was 9 years old and represented one of his rare crimes of opportunity. A child playing with a ball as the afternoon sunlight died. An open gate, the ball drifting into an empty street of big houses set back from the road. Good fortune. God, if he existed, finding his attention briefly distracted. And inside, the gray man danced.